Who is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor, or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of power.
Executive order.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some of the things that you may have forgotten or slept through in middle school. Today, we're picking up on a few questions you sent us about intelligence.
Hey, guys. My name is Toby Johnson, and my question is this. What is the relationship between the various national intelligence agencies, and how do the various head of departments, such as the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Attorney General work together? Who does what and who reports to who? Thank you very much.
Dr. Amy Ziegert is here to shed some light on agencies which, by their very nature, operate in secrecy. She's co-director of Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. She's also an intelligence and national security expert who's authored three books. Amy Ziegert, welcome.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
So glad you're here, because there is so much to pick apart. Like, what are the various intelligence agencies operating in the federal government?
So there are 17 different agencies at the federal level alone in the United States intelligence community. And of course, the CIA is kind of the 800-pound gorilla. But there are a number of different agencies, and we've had more agencies being created over time. So the first intelligence agencies were created in the military, in the Army and the Navy, and those date back to the 19th century. But the modern intelligence community, this sprawling network of 17 agencies, is really a 20th century creation.
So this sprawl, how do they differ in scope and methods and practice? I'm not asking you to go through all 17, but in general.
Well, I'll give you the, sort of the big ones. The newest kid on the block is called the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, or the DNI, and that was created after 9/11. So one of the big challenges in intelligence forever, really, in American history is there's been a complaint that we don't centralize and coordinate intelligence enough. And so the CIA was originally created after Pearl Harbor to try to bring together the existing agencies in the military. After 9/11, the thinking was that even that wasn't enough, and we needed a super CIA director, and that's the Director of National Intelligence. So that's Dan Coats today. Before him, it was Jim Clapper, and that position is supposed to oversee all of the U.S. intelligence community, but they have a hard time doing that for a lot of bureaucratic reasons that have to do with budgets and people. So that's the DNI. The second biggie is the National Security Agency. We hear a lot about that. They're the code breakers, the wiretappers, the folks who intercept email and telephone communications. And the National Security Agency was so secret that for years, NSA stood for no such agency. People wouldn't even admit that it existed. So it's come out of the shadows in recent years, thanks to Edward Snowden's revelations and, of course, news reports about warrantless wiretapping and other controversies. Let me just briefly mention two other agencies, one which we hear a lot about and one which we don't. The FBI is an intelligence agency. So when we're talking about cyber hacking by the Russians in the election, that's why the FBI is actually front and center in conducting that investigation. They're our premier counterintelligence organization, trying to figure out if there are folks trying to penetrate our elections or penetrate our domestic systems or penetrate our agencies. And then finally, there's an agency called the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office. And these guys you don't hear a lot about, but they build and operate all the spy satellites for the United States around the world. So that gives you just a flavor of the big intelligence agencies that take up a lot of the budget and have a lot of personnel. But then we have intelligence agencies in the Coast Guard, in the Department of the Treasury, in all sorts of smaller agencies that provide tailored intelligence about things like how do we know what's on container ships coming into ports? How do we know what aluminum tubes are for in Iraq? For example, the Department of Energy has experts in that. So there's a reason why we have so many agencies, though it's become more of a sprawling network, I think, than anyone ever intended.
So who's in charge?
Oh, that's such a good question. The short answer is it depends. nominally, the director of national intelligence is supposed to be in charge of the whole thing.
This is also a person that they call the intelligence czar.
Yes. And usually when someone's called a czar, it means they don't really have the informal or the formal power to get the job done. So the CIA really plays an outsized role in intelligence because the CIA is the one agency in the intelligence community that brings together what we call all source collection. So they fuse together all the different kinds of intelligence that we get. So I mentioned the National Security Agency intercepts phone calls and emails, by the way, not on American citizens without a warrant. But their job is to eavesdrop on foreign leaders and collect what they call signals intelligence. The CIA helps bring all of that information with human intelligence, the James Bond stuff that we typically think about. So they collect human intelligence, they bring together all these different types of intelligence, and they provide analysis. And so the CIA really is the biggest player on the block when it comes to the intelligence community. But they don't have power over these other agencies. They have to kind of jostle and try to work together in order to put the whole thing together. And that's always been a challenge in American history.
Since 9/11, there have been several calls from lawmakers to reform, to modernize, to kind of centralize the intelligence communities. Is that working? I mean, are they working together better now?
It's better than it was before 9/11, but that's a pretty low bar, the before 9/11 bar. So I spent 5 years looking at why we didn't adapt to the terrorist threat in the intelligence community in the decade before 9/11. What went wrong? And what I found was that we recognized the gravity of the terrorist threat years before 9/11. Intelligence officials saw it. Policymakers saw it. There were recommendations for intelligence reform, centralization, improving that James Bond human intelligence. And so the $64,000 question is why? If you know the magnitude of the threat and you know what you need to do, why couldn't we get from here to there? And it's a complicated answer, but it has to do with how our political system works. So if you think about, there are three ways to reform a big bureaucracy. The first is you can do it yourself, right? You can have internal reform. But nobody likes change in an organization. There are always people who want to keep things exactly the way they are. So internal reform is by nature hard. So imagine telling all the Soviet specialists that they're no longer so valuable and they've got to learn Pashto so they can work in Afghanistan, or they now need to become terrorism experts and go to places that they never thought they'd want to study or go to before. So internal reform is naturally hard. The second route to reform is the president demands reform. But presidents don't usually take on intelligence reform because nobody ever votes for a president based on the inner workings of the Central Intelligence Agency. Mm-hmm. It's just not a political winner. And then the third route to reform is legislation. And as I'm sure all your listeners will already know, legislation is really hard to pass, even in the best of times. There are always going to be opponents to any kind of bill, and they can sabotage that bill and make sure that reform never passes. And that's exactly what happened before 9/11. Lots of efforts to pass intelligence reform bills, and none of them succeeded before the terrorist attacks.
Outside of oversight, though, how do intelligence agencies work with Congress or congressional intelligence committees?
Well, it really depends on the leadership of the committees. So we didn't have any intelligence committees for decades, actually. We didn't have intelligence oversight committees until the 1970s. So there was a big series of scandals in the 1970s, the revelations in the New York Times that the United States had been involved in all sorts of illegal activities abroad through our intelligence agencies, and by the way, illegal activities here at home, spying on American citizens, infiltrating groups like spying on Martin Luther King Jr., Vietnam War protesters. And so all of this information came to light in the 1970s, and there was a congressional committee called the Church Committee. You'll hear a lot of reference to it today. We need a church committee. And the Church Committee did an incredible service to our nation. They released an unclassified version of all of these terrible things that the intelligence agencies had done, and they recommended reforms. And some of the major reforms they recommended were that Congress needed to step up and have permanent intelligence committees rather than just a handful of people in a back room saying, wink, wink, nod, nod, do what you're doing. So that's why we have the oversight committees that we have today. And it really depends pretty dramatically on who the leaders of those committees are, how they operate, and how vigorous that oversight is. Because members of Congress don't get rewarded for overseeing the intelligence community. Remember, mm-hmm. it's all secret. They can't even tell their constituents back home what they're doing.
Yeah.
So it's not really rewarded at the polls, which is what they really care about.
How about the other way around, working with the intelligence community? I'm sure you can think of many instances of information or reporting from intelligence that have influenced policy. Anything come to mind?
Yes. Well, we typically look publicly, myself included, at intelligence failures. But there have been many, many intelligence successes. And one of the lamentations I hear from senior intelligence officials is that their successes are all too often secret, and their failures are usually public. And I think that's true. But just to give them one of the more recent examples, we got Osama bin Laden.
Right.
Now think about that for a minute. Of course, he didn't have any internet. He burned his trash. He had a compound with almost no access to the outside world. And it took a tremendous effort over many, many years of collection and analysis, connecting those dots deep inside the CIA to piece together the information that the guy they referred to as the Pacer, because they could only get satellite imagery of him from overhead. They knew he was tall and was walking around his garden, was the Pacer Osama bin Laden. And on that fateful meeting in the Situation Room where President Obama has to decide whether to send SEAL Team 6 in to get bin Laden, he went around the room and he asked people for their estimates of whether they thought the Pacer was actually Osama bin Laden. And a senior CIA official at the time, Michael Morell, who's a tremendous public servant, has written about how he told Obama, he said, "I was more confident that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq than that this man is Osama bin Laden." Because the evidence was just not, it's never a smoking gun. They went around the room and the estimates that the guy was bin Laden ranged from 95% to 40%. And at one point, the president said, "Just 40%? And the head of the National Counterterrorism Center said, "Mr. President, that's 38% more than we've ever had before." Right. It's hard. It's
wow.
really hard.
What a story. But and of course, a story of a president taking the advice of the intelligence apparatus. More recently, President Trump has directly said, and White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci repeated, that he does not accept CIA, FBI, and NSA conclusions that Russia attempted to influence the 2016 election. Now, this, I want to clarify, was reported before President Trump's inauguration. But what happens in a case like that when you have a president that does not trust his intelligence apparatus?
Well, Virginia, this is a very, very disturbing situation for our nation. Look, presidents often have healthy skepticism of intelligence, and they should, because intelligence is an art. It's not a science. It's not a crystal ball. I tell my undergraduates at Stanford, we think that intelligence is like Professor Trelawney in Harry Potter, where she can read the tea leaves and gaze into her crystal ball and tell you exactly what's going to happen. That's not what intelligence is. Intelligence is about piecing together bits of information. Mind you, your adversaries are trying to give you wrong information, deceptive information. So it's right that presidents have a healthy dose of skepticism about the assessments of their community. But in this case, there's a broader context here. President Trump has essentially declared war on his own intelligence agencies, and he started this war before he even came to power. He's called them Nazis. He's called intelligence PR. He's revealed highly, highly classified information, blurting it out in meetings with people that blew a source of a key ally of the United States. And so this continued resistance to the high confidence judgments. High confidence means is a big deal in the intelligence world. It's not just that the NSA and the CIA and the FBI said, "Well, we think maybe Russia interfered in the election." It's a high confidence judgment. That is as good as it gets. So the fact that the president is saying he doesn't believe his intelligence agencies is hugely damaging for our national security. It's hugely damaging for the morale of these agencies. And it raises questions about whether the president is getting good information for any of his foreign policy decisions if he doesn't inherently trust the men and women of the intelligence community to give him the ground truth as best as they know it.
Amy Siegert, you've been studying the intelligence community for years and going back for decades in its history. What can you tell us as a sort of takeaway for what we should think about as citizens in these essentially secretive organizations?
Well, let me just say, Virginia, that I've been pretty critical of the intelligence community at various points in my work. So I spare no criticism when it comes to the workings of the CIA or the FBI. But my biggest takeaway in spending now 2 decades studying these agencies and interviewing these people and reviewing their successes and failures is we live in an incredible country that the men and women of these agencies, almost to a person, are tremendous public servants, and they're silent warriors. We talk a lot about the military in this country, and we owe them a debt of gratitude. But folks in the intelligence community are operating in secret. They are risking their lives. They do it because they love their country. And I even tell my own oldest son, who's a computer scientist, you know, you really should think about working for the NSA one day. But so far, he doesn't listen to me.
Dr. Amy Siegert, she's co-director of Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of 3 books, including Eyes on Spies, Congress, and the U.S. Intelligence Community, Spying Blind and Flawed by Design. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, before we go today, a quick request, or you could consider it an assignment if that helps. Please rate our podcast. Now, we know that when it comes to approval ratings in politics, the bar is currently set pretty low, but we really do want to hear from you because your ratings and reviews help us shape the curriculum and do the best job that we possibly can. So go to Apple Podcasts and don't be afraid to tell us exactly what you think. Hopefully, we're doing better than Congress. This episode was produced by me, Virginia Prescott, and edited by Taylor Quimby. Music from Broke for Free. Civics 101 is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Okay, you're free to go. Class dismissed.